has to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thank you for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Do you love books? I do. Joining us in just a moment is New York University professor Mark Crispin Miller, and he is the editor of a new series called The Forbidden Bookshelf. These are books that are either out of print or that were kind of suppressed or killed at the time they were first published. They are important works that explain part of America's history, ranging from the Phoenix Program in Vietnam to the ugly ways that women got abortions before Roe versus Wade. First, I always like to thank the people who support my work here at PBC.com through your subscriptions. Today, we thank Gerald Van Atta, Natalie Real in Montana, Sally Soriana, and Nicholas Yaksich. Thanks to each and every one of you for your continuing support. And I invite others to join you. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the link under my picture that says sign up. Gives you choices, $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. New annual subscribers in the U.S. Get a copy of John Diss' rock and roll CD with political overtones and undertones. It's called Red Flag. I'm grateful to all of you who support my work and who listen to our podcasts. Remember when books were written on typewriters? And do you remember when controversial books could be published in this country? Stimulating thought, provoking discussion, and exercising the First Amendment. A song for writers from Brian Ferry and Roxy Music called Kiss and Tell. Returning to our program today is Mark Crispin Miller, professor at New York University and a longtime author and activist on many important subjects. My bookshelf still features both editions of Fooled Again, The Real Case for Electoral Reform, and he was the editor of Loser Take All, which also covers our very problematic election system in this country. Professor Miller, thanks for joining me today.
It's great to be back with you, Peter.
I also want to note your long-running effort on the Internet News from the Underground. And I consider it a very valuable resource when you take a hiatus. I really notice it, Mark.
Yeah, we had to change servers, and you know that put me in a kind of hiatus hell for several weeks. But we're back at markcrispinmiller.com.
If you sign up for those alerts, I don't know if you do this on your own, Mark, but almost every day there are somewhere between 3 and 12 blasts that you send out with links to important coverage that is not generally featured in the corporate mainstream media.
Yeah, and a lot of it isn't featured in the left liberal media either.
Yeah.
You know, the problem facing us is not just a matter of corporate control, I'm afraid. It's broader than that. But yeah, if people go to the website and look on the right-hand side, they can each sign up to get those items that are posted on the website as emails.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the listserv we maintain.
And do you do this all yourself?
Yeah, actually, I do. I mean, I have some technical help because I'm not gifted that way. But people send me things often, and I find a lot of stuff on my own, and it just seems to me to be a democratic necessity. I don't have to tell you that because that's what your show is all about. People need to know this stuff, and they're not getting it from the press.
Well, I want to thank you because I thought you had some elves there, or you know, even interns or students who participated in a project to help scour the web for the articles and links that you send out.
I could use some elves, you know, if anyone wants to volunteer to become an elf. Santa's workshop is open. But, it's just something I do on my own.
So, Mark, these are dark days for free expression, for the First Amendment. And there's an important statement from New York Times reporter James Risen, which is rippling through the Internet these days, that President Obama is the greatest single threat to press freedom and expression that we are permitted under the First Amendment. I'd like to get your take on the real seriousness of the problem we confront.
Yeah, we are dangerously deprived of free information, of the kind of information that keeps us free, the kind of information which was really the purpose of the First Amendment, which was, you know, drafted not so that publishers could make money off of edgy novels. You know, we have to remind ourselves that the First Amendment is really not about protecting erotic literature. That was probably the furthest thing from James Madison's mind, if it was even in the same universe with that mind. You know, we're all used to hearing these stories of heroic resistance to blue-nosed censors, you know, whether it's James Franco playing Allen Ginsberg in the movie on the, you know, the Howl trial, Lady Chatterley's lover. You know, we hear these stories all the time, Ulysses. And you know, it's a great thing that those books are available, don't get me wrong, but that's not the purpose of the First Amendment, you know, to protect that kind of expression. Its purpose is to make sure that the American people know what their government is up to, know what's being done in their name, and also know their own rights under the Constitution, because an uninformed public is sure to become an enslaved population, an impoverished population, a victimized population. So I caught your statement in the intro that there was a time when controversial books could be published. That is true, especially in the 70s. It was kind of a golden age of critical expression when a number of writers dug into episodes in our national past, did histories of powerful forces like the DuPont family. This was part of the same moment that saw the press beginning to examine what the CIA was really up to, when Congress was beginning to, you know, mount the same kind of investigation. And there were a lot of books that started to, as I say, awaken the American people from the stupor that the Cold War had plunged everybody into.
Mm-hmm.
But it's important to note, Peter, that even then there were books that would get killed or couldn't get published in the first place. And there really is not a time in our modern history when there weren't books that were done in one way or another. Now, it's important to make a distinction between outright censorship, you know, the banning, the formal and official banning of books,
mm-hmm.
and the kind of thing that actually does go on instead of that, because the First Amendment forbids that kind of censorship. As we all know, the state can't exercise prior restraint on news stories, although they have done so. The state cannot consign a book to the flames. This is not Iran, you know, this isn't Russia. We have...
But they can redact the hell out of it.
will that's just it. They can redact it, and they can kill it outright through other means.
Right.
And I guess this is the sort of segue into talking about the forbidden bookshelf, right?
Yes, it is. I'm setting you up.
Thank you so much. I so appreciate it. Yeah, I'm editing this series called Forbidden Bookshelf, whose purpose is to make these vitally important works that have been out of print for some time available again with new introductions. And this is something I've always wanted to do, because over the years I've been increasingly struck by how many really great books are just not out there, are unknown, have either been forgotten by the people who once read them, or are books that nobody seems to have heard of. And as I've, you know, started digging into this subject in order to come up with titles for this series, I've been really sort of flabbergasted by how many such books there are.
Mm-hmm.
There really is a vast library of books that were either killed in one way or another, or have been conveniently forgotten. You can't say they've been killed, but they slipped out of print, and something about them made it unlikely that anyone would rush to bring them back.
Mm-hmm.
So,
now, Mark, I want to get to your criteria, and I want to ask you a little bit about the development of the forbidden bookshelf. But first, just a little bit about you. My suspicion is that your blood type is actually I. I for ink. And
I thought you were going to say I for insane.
No. I believe that ink runs through your veins. I know that your parents own a small press in Chicago.
Right.
And I just know of your love of books. So take a moment here to talk about your own reverence for the expression of authors and the printed page.
Yeah, well, I guess you're right. My parents, they actually just sold it because they're quite old now, although they're still involved. It's called Academy Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, since the mid-70s, were publishing books in the way that all publishing companies formerly published books, which is to say, mainly out of a love for books. I mean, that's kind of a rare thing today, now that most mainstream publishing has been ingested by the media cartel, whose managers expect books to turn outrageously high profits when books have never been that lucrative. Books are unique, you know, among our media, in that they, first of all, aren't dependent on advertising, which makes authors freer, at least nominally freer, than people who work in TV or on, you know, commercial radio. And it's not a mass medium like cinema, so you're not necessarily that dependent. Well, you're not supposed to be dependent on huge numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the publishing industry has been seriously distorted by that corporate ownership. So that's actually one of the reasons why many of the books we're bringing back have been unavailable for complicated reasons having to do with the tax laws. It's no longer affordable for publishers to warehouse their backlists. Did you know that? They can't write off the cost of keeping copies of their backlist warehoused.
Mm, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's something that could be changed, actually. That's something that the IRS could change. Someone should sue over this and make it a Supreme Court case. But we now have the really unfortunate phenomenon of publishers pulping copies of their backlist because they simply can't afford to warehouse them. So,
And just explain briefly, is it a tax issue where they're taxed on the inventory even before it is sold?
Well, what happened was they had been able to do this, and then there was a really terrible legal decision that equated books with machine parts, and machine parts couldn't be warehoused, so books couldn't be either. There was no distinction made between them. The name of the decision escapes me, but it did have, you know, a subtly destructive effect on freedom of expression and the literary marketplace, because a lot of books are just not there anymore. So, you know, that's simply broadened the range of titles that we're bringing back in Forbidden Bookshelf.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to do roughly 12 titles a year. Sadly, they will be available only as e-books, and I've got enough ink in my bloodstream to regret that because I love books, you know, and
I'm
used to books.
I'm adjusting to e-books, but Mark, I have to tell you that I don't have a photographic memory, but when I read a passage on a printed page, I can call that up in my mind. When I read something on a screen, it doesn't have the same, I don't have the same ability to recall it. And I know there are little gizmos in my iPad where I can bookmark, I can highlight, I can, you know, edit sections out and save them. But it's not the same as being able to bend back the corner of a page and take a highlighter or an ink pen and circle the important parts for future reference. And so I am, you know, having the same difficult transition you're describing.
Well, that's a fascinating point about the memorability of text on the screen. I hadn't thought of that at all. I guess I'll just keep that to myself because, you know, we're trying to get people to buy these e-books, and they're very affordable, which is the upside.
Yeah.
And I will add that in the event that some of these titles will be adopted for classroom use in high schools or colleges, the publisher, which is Open Road Media, will do print-on-demand hard copies. But it's not just given the, you know, the economics of the whole machine. We couldn't do this if we had to print paper copies, unfortunately.
Yeah.
At any rate, the books will be available again. That's the point. And I want to add something, an important point here. Sometimes people say, well, why do this? I mean, I can go online and get a used copy on Amazon. Well, the answer to that is twofold. First of all, you cannot always do that. Some of the books we are republishing cost $2,000 as used copies on Amazon because they're quite scarce.
Mm-hmm.
But the other and more important point is that if you go online to buy a used copy of a book, that presupposes that you know the book exists. You know it's there, so you go to buy it. We're publishing these books, publishing them. That doesn't just mean making them physically available. It also means making the world aware of them. It means trying to get reviews of them again, trying to generate buzz about them, right? Because the value of these books lies precisely in their potential for sparking essential debate and dialogue, because they're all extremely they're timely, and they deal with vitally important issues that, you know, let's be honest, a range of powerful interests would prefer we all kind of forget, you know? So
And if I can just provide this handle, you're kind of freshly curating these books and bringing them to the attention of people who hopefully will be attracted to one of the titles or subjects, and through that you can broaden their interest by piquing that interest in the other titles that you're offering.
That's right. It really is kind of like a big box of chocolates, although they have you know, kind of a strange aftertaste. But well, you know.
But plenty of nuts too.
But plenty of nuts. if people go to forbiddenbookshelf.com, they can find the first five titles that we brought out in June. I guess I'll rush through them.
No, you don't have to rush. We're in a podcast here, so please
good,
thumbnail them, but don't rush.
Okay.
Now, let's start with Blowback by Christopher Simpson. And I just want to tell you right off the bat, I thought Chalmers Johnson had coined the term blowback for the trilogy of books that he wrote, which are also on my bookshelf near yours. But what is the date of the original publication of Simpson's book entitled Blowback?
Well, it's 1988. And Chalmers Johnson's trilogy is just a great work. You know, it's indispensable. I think it tells us something that he went ahead and called his books Blowback, probably because he didn't know about Christopher Simpson's book. which is the first and still, I believe, the best history of U.S. recruitment of Nazis and fascists after World War II for the purposes of the Cold War, and its disastrous impact on American foreign and domestic policy.
Yeah.
Chris, you know, wrote this book at a time, you know, it was the Reagan years, and he had a lot of trouble finding an American publisher until he finally found one and wrote a whole manuscript and submitted it only to have the publisher say, ah, this is not for us. Now, it's a superb book. It's riveting. I mean, it really is a shocking history of how we basically protected and rewarded and employed tens of thousands of Nazi and fascist war criminals. It's not a boring book by any stretch of the imagination, but it was not for this publisher, probably because it was too riveting, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So the book was then published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson, a British house that happened to be eager to break into the U.S. market. So the book did come out. It got good reviews. It got he won some awards for it. However, there was a negative review, very interestingly, in the New York Times book review by Sergei Shmaiman, a reporter there,
mm-hmm.
whose father was actually involved with some of the fascist movements that Chris writes about, but doesn't mention that in his review, okay?
Uh-huh.
So that bad review had a depressing effect on sales, whereas to be fair, Herbert Mittgang of the Daily Times gave it a very good review. Chris was actually pretty lucky in that regard because the next book we'll talk about from that first tranche of five titles
mm-hmm.
is The Phoenix Program by Douglas Valentine.
Yes.
That's a masterpiece, an amazing and horrifying history of this enormous covert CIA operation in South Vietnam during the war, intended to pacify the South Vietnamese population through a program of abduction, assassination, torture, and rape, carried out under the auspices of the CIA using squads of ferocious South Vietnamese criminal troops. It is an amazing story of what that war was really all about, and it's also, as Doug notes in his new introduction, The Phoenix Has Landed, kind of a template for what he says has been happening in this country since 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
The use of high-tech mass surveillance. They did this in Vietnam with a computer database of names in Saigon. We do it now, as everyone knows, through the NSA and other agencies. The use of secret courts to indict people without their knowledge or opportunity to defend themselves. Military detention of civilians, I should say, has now been enabled under Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Doug points out that we need to know about the Phoenix program, not just because of what it meant for the Vietnamese, and also what it then meant for the populations of dozens of other countries worldwide, but also for what it means to us as citizens of this threatened democracy. Now, this is a great book, and you can go online and read a number of reviews by experts who have taken the trouble to review the new edition. When it came out, however, it was trashed again in the New York Times book review by CBS newsman Morley Safer. And I invite people to go and find that review because it's just a wonder of irrelevance and triviality. He did everything he could to try to trash the book and yet managed to stay off the main subject. And it took a toll on Doug's, not only on the book, but on Doug's career as a writer. It kind of dimmed his luster in the eyes of mainstream publishers.
And Mark, I just want to comment that these two titles really, you know, bring up important issues for me. And that is that we have recycled COINTELPRO into total information awareness and the expanded domestic role of the NSA. And when it comes to the CIA, the battle over the release of the heavily redacted torture review, it's not a report, not an investigation, it's a review, which cannot lead to any charges or accountability for those who are reviewed in the review. And it has been edited by George Tenet and other people who are exposed for wrongdoing in this report. And our failure to learn from previous mistakes and our failure to really recognize what we did in the Cold War and in Vietnam and how we have reprised that with new high-tech tools and bigger budgets and a bigger buy-in by most Americans, to me, is really troubling.
Oh, I share your view, and you really put that very eloquently. It's absolutely true. You know, people close their eyes to this kind of thing at their own peril. You know, to sort of just digress for a moment, this notion of conspiracy theory has been used for decades now to discourage people from looking too closely into evidence of certain high crimes by the state.
Mm-hmm.
And a book that I actually helped bring into the world called Conspiracy Theory in America makes this point. It's part of a series I edit for the University of Texas Press, and it's by Lance DeHaven Smith. I recommend it very highly because what he does is he explains how the concept or the meme of conspiracy theory entered journalistic discourse in America at a very specific time in 1967. Prior to that date, if you go into the archives of the New York Times or the Washington Post or Time Magazine and do a search on that phrase, you'll find that it was very rarely used by reporters and used inconsistently, used to refer to a range of things. Starting in 1967, it's used always and only and increasingly to deride, ridicule discussions of the possibility of some kind of high crime by the state.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we know precisely when it entered the language because there was a CIA memo drafted and was declassified in the 70s, over some litigation, which instructed all station chiefs worldwide to help discredit two books that had come out questioning the findings of the Warren Commission report. One was by Mark Lane, and mm-hmm. the other was by Edward J. Epstein. They were mm-hmm. very different books, politically quite different. Lane was this big progressive, and Epstein was quite conservative. He believed that, Castro was behind the assassination. That doesn't matter where the authors stood on the political spectrum. What matters is they were questioning the Warren Commission report, and the CIA had the job of discrediting those books and explicitly advised that agents, or I should say officers, worldwide use their media assets and propaganda assets and friends in the media, and that's a direct quote,
mm-hmm.
to discredit the work of these conspiracy theorists by making the following five arguments. And then there are these specious arguments like, well, if there was a conspiracy, someone would have talked by now.
Right,
These are things we still hear today when it's election fraud that's being denied, or when it's this, there are so many such stories, I don't even know how to begin to list them.
Well, let me just interject 9/11, because I am not intimidated by the people who call me a tin hat truther or, some kind of a wacky conspiracy theorist. I was there for the 9/11 Commission hearings. It was bogus. It is a whitewash. I have interviewed so many people who offered evidence and testimony to the 9/11 Commission who were completely ignored. And so I don't go to the point where I say I know what the accurate conspiracy theory is. I only know that the best-selling report of Cain and Hamilton was loaded with half-truth, spin, and disinformation.
That's right. No, that's the best contemporary example of the kind of thing I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a virtual industry of ridicule aimed at 9/11 truthers. I even hesitate to use that expression because it is itself a pejorative term that's
sure.
used to
mm-hmm.
marginalize people who are raising perfectly rational, totally evidence-based points. I just happened to watch Massimo Mazzucco's three-disc DVD, 9/11, The New Pearl Harbor. Did you happen to see this?
I have not seen it, no.
Oh, I cannot recommend it highly enough. It was made with the blessing of David Ray Griffin.
Mm-hmm.
And in close partnership with artists and engineers for 9/11 Truth.
Uh-huh.
Three discs, Peter. It's quite long. It's a comprehensive takedown of the debunkers.
Mm-hmm.
And its subtext basically is, although it doesn't make this point so explicitly, that all this talk of conspiracy theory, all this snickering to get us not to notice what's actually going on, is profoundly dangerous to the survival of the Republic. That's kind of Lance DeHaven Smith's point in the book, Conspiracy Theory in America, that the successful propagation of this notion of conspiracy theory in the late 60s and then all throughout the decades since has actually changed the way that Americans think about government power. He makes the point that historically Americans have always been ready to believe without any hesitation that elites are capable of mounting efforts against their own rights. I'm not putting this grammatically. Americans have always had a healthy distrust of elites.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have not hesitated to believe that elites are capable of trying to take away their freedom or or rob them. The Declaration of Independence is a conspiracy theory. I mean, read it. If it came out today, right, it would be laughed off as the product of disordered minds. You look at our history through, the Jackson era up through the late 19th century. You recall that Charles Beard wrote a book on the economic interpretation of the Constitution that argued that the framers, were engaged in basically trying to serve their own class interests and had economic motives for crafting the American government as they did. This book got a respectful hearing. It wasn't laughed off as a kind of, lunatic exercise. For people now to have this tendency to say, as we've all heard people say many, many times, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but think about that.
Yeah.
You know, that's really very dangerous, because when people say that, the thing that they then say, having made clear that they're not conspiracy theorists, are invariably very sensible things. They make perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think, that anyone in his right mind can deny that the elites are now really out for blood. I mean, they want to take over in an absolute sense. We now have a class of egregiously wealthy people. We have a plutocracy on steroids now.
Mm-hmm.
We have a class of billionaires that's militarized the police from coast to coast. We have an NSA that has no compunction whatsoever about recording every single thing that we say and write to each other. All of this under a presumably liberal president, as articulate as George W. Bush was mush-mouthed. But I think we're in very, very dangerous times. I could go on and on in this vein. This is precisely the moment at which it's now time for us all to snap out of it and stop believing that there's something crazy about thinking that elites conspire, because they do. And the disappearance of all the books that we've been discussing has everything to do with how it is that people, can't see what's right in front of their eyes.
And the desire to rewrite or smooth out narratives that might arouse people against the 1%.
That's right. Absolutely. It's a kind of fairy tale version of the American past.
Yeah.
Well,
so let me return to the titles here on the Forbidden Bookshelf, because I was intrigued by your inclusion of Interference, a book about the NFL. Are you a football fan?
Well, I'm not especially a football fan, but I am fascinated by organized crime, and more generally, I believe that really solid works of scholarship and journalism that tell us things that we need to know ought to be available and ought to be the subject of discussion. Interference, by the great crime reporter Dan Moldea, is about the NFL's involvement with organized crime. it's quite an eye opener, you know, because gambling is legal gambling has had a great deal to do with how the NFL has conducted its business and how games have been thrown and so on. This is a massive, riveting book that when it came out in the 90s, Keith Olbermann said it's the best book on sports in the language, okay? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's high praise. What happened was, here again, the New York Times is the culprit. You know, Dan says in the book, he predicts that sports writers loyal to the NFL will attack the book, he predicts it in the book, and that's exactly what happened. A New York Times sports writer reviewed the book for the Times Book Review, and it was a maliciously distorted review. I mean, it made claims that were false. It attacked him for not mentioning things that the book does mention. It was so egregious, it was such a hatchet job, that Dan actually sued the Times, which started his journalistic career. I mean, a paper he revered, he sued them, arguing that opinion writers ought to be held to the same standard of factual accuracy as reporters, which I think is a rational position. This case went all the way up to the Supreme Court. An appeals court found for him, and then the same judge reversed himself, which I'd never heard of before. And then when it got to the Supreme Court, Dan lost. However, and by the way, let me add that the review killed the book. It topped out at 19,000 sales. And there was supposed to be a paperback deal, and it was canceled. So, so he really did pay the price, and so did we all. So we included that book in our first tranche because it was definitely killed, and it's something that most Americans are going to find interesting. And indeed, Keith Olbermann had Dan back on his show on ESPN a couple months ago when the book came out. Now, the last two of the first five books are a little different from the first three in that neither of them was deliberately killed. They fall into the category of books that have been conveniently forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
And the first, and sort of interestingly, the one that so far has sold the most copies, is also the very oldest because it was published in 1935 by Frederick Lewis Allen, a very popular historian of the day. And it's called The Lords of Creation. And what it is a history of the financial consolidation of the American economy by the 1% of that era, starting at the turn of the 20th century, under the guidance of J.P. Morgan and others. It talks about how these interests sort of began the cycle of unrelenting booms and busts that screw everybody else and leave many, not all, of the wealthiest in even better shape. Now, the book was written in the heart of the Great Depression. It is a brilliantly written, highly readable, and often sardonically hilarious history of these financial machinations. We have a new introduction by Gretchen Morgenson of the New York Times, maybe their best financial reporter. And she nails it. She says this book is dated in a few ways, but in the main, it could have been written yesterday. And anyone who wants to understand how the 1% operates needs to read this book, which, let me add, is one of those that costs $2,000 if you want to buy it online.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only one of Frederick Lewis Allen's books that was out of print. You know, he wrote Only Yesterday, a very famous history of the era from the 90s, you know, the 1890s on up to the 20s, still in print. These books have been still in print, but not The Lords of Creation.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And I just want to note, I've read the book about the Phoenix program, but all these others are new to me. And I pride myself. I try to keep up on things, and I read 30 or 40 books a year. Mm-hmm. So I really welcome the and I say recycling here in a positive way, but the the fresh launch of these books in ways that can help people understand history and how a lot of it is playing out in similar ways today. And your last title is about the issue of abortion. And that's something that I'm very concerned about, that progressives and in particular the Democratic Party are not really fighting to maintain the status quo in terms of access to abortion services. And we now have a dozen states where there is either a single clinic left or these pretextual laws have forced the closure or are in the process of forcing the closure of the remaining clinics. And,
exactly.
And you know, where is Obama on this issue? Where are the Democratic leaders and women like Nancy Pelosi, who have really led the charge to serve Democratic women voters on this issue? And now, I believe because of polling and market research, they've decided that it's a 50-50 matter, and it's simply too risky politically to stand up for these critical rights.
I couldn't have put it better. And this is why we're bringing back this classic study. It's called The Search for an Abortionist, written by Nancy Howell Lee, a sociologist. It's a dispassionate look at what women had to do before Roe v. Wade. This book was published in 1969. It's based on interviews with 114 women who had all been faced with unwanted pregnancy. And it lets them tell their stories of what they had to go through in order to deal with that problem. There are a broad range of experiences, you know, some tragic, some horrific, some turned out okay. But if people want sort of the last word on what the landscape's going to be like if these right-wing Christianist interests prevail with the, you know, acquiescence of the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. they can do no better than to read this book, which also, incidentally, makes quite clear, sort of implicitly, that making abortion illegal is not going to stop it.
Yeah.
You know, all these women went and had abortions. All it's going to do is make them dangerous, right? So,
it'll criminalize it in ways that will have bizarre impacts on practitioners and the patients too.
That's exactly right. So this is a book that both, you know, as we say, both sides should read. I mean, it's because it's not in any way polemical. It's mm-hmm. but it's you can't put it down by the same token. So those are the five that we've done already, and then on September 16th we'll be bringing out our next five. So I guess. I should talk about those, right?
Well, tell us first a little bit about your criteria, and if you're interested in any suggestions from our listeners here of titles for you to consider.
Well, I certainly am interested. Since we started, I've been getting lots of messages from people and calls as well, suggesting titles, you know, many of which have turned out to be really right on, just exactly what we're looking for. Mm-hmm. Often people don't realize that these books are still in print. It takes a fair amount of legwork to determine whether a book is really out of print and then to figure out who owns the rights. It's quite complicated.
Yeah.
You can't just grab something and publish it. I mean, we're not Google, you know. So
well, and talk a little bit about that, because Google is digitizing. You know, they have this project to try to digitize every book, and of course, there are concerns about exactly, you know, what kind of ads they'll serve, or if we read their books, you know, how that's going to show up in our profile for future service of ads. But do you support Google's digitizing effort? I think it's called the Book Project or something like that.
Well, it's just too undiscriminating, you know, because they scoop up a lot of books that are not theirs to take, and you know, I believe authors have a right to the fruits of their labor. They
mm-hmm.
they have a right to earn a living. And so, you know, I've had books of my own turn up, you know, that way, and I've had to take steps to have them taken down. This happens a great deal. So when it comes to books that are now in the public domain and not readily available, I think it's great that Google makes them available. Although, as you point out, you're vulnerable to have your reading habits recorded by the state because it's so, you know, transparent and
right.
so on.
Yeah. So, but, Mark, thumbnail for us the next round of books that you're planning to release in September.
Okay. We're doing I.F. Stone's Hidden History of the Korean War, a masterpiece that actually demonstrates how that war both started and how the Truman administration and General MacArthur did everything they could to exploit that war and prolong it and use it to kickstart the military-industrial complex and get the draft reinstated. It reads like a novel. In fact, Stone says at the beginning he kind of meant to write it as if it were a novel. 28 American publishers turned it down before the Monthly Review Press, you know, this sort of commie house, took it. And then it came out in the second edition, which was also, you know, quickly disappeared. We have a great new introduction by Bruce Cummings of the University of Chicago, who also wrote the introduction to the second edition. Beautiful piece. And this is a must-read for anyone who you know, wants a sense of the backstory to, like, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, things like that,
mm-hmm.
because the Korean War was definitely a football for these anti-communist interests back in 1950, who were terrified that peace might break out, you know, 5 years after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, we're doing, and I'm extremely pleased about this, DuPont Dynasty by Gerard Colby. This is a magisterial history of the DuPont family from the time they arrived in the U.S. in 1800 all the way up to the 80s, and then he's got a new introduction bringing the story forward. It's the most powerful industrial family in America, which mutated into an enormously powerful financial family. They were heavily involved in the attempted coup that wasn't attempted. It was a planned coup to get FDR out of the White House in 1934. That story's in the book. Their involvement with the Nazis, that's in the book. Their indefatigable efforts to break the labor movement, that's in the book. Their crimes against the environment and the cover-ups thereof, that's all there. How they have colonized the state of Delaware. It's an amazing book, which the DuPonts managed to have killed twice. They killed it when it came out for the first time in 1974, by pressuring Prentice Hall into basically suspending the press run. And then they somehow managed to get the second publisher, Lyle Stewart, to, I don't know how this happened, but the pages in that edition describing the suppression of the first edition are all missing from the second edition.
Whoa.
It's unbelievable. Anyway.
Must have been a problem at the press.
Yeah, it must have been. a glitch. Anyway, we're bringing it back, and this is no exaggeration. If anyone wants a kind of alternative history of the United States, you know, wants to get a sense of who was calling the shots and how, and what interests were at stake, and how you know, the workers were systematically screwed, you got to read DuPont Dynasty. It's a great book, and it will be back in mid-September.
All right.
The third book is The Assassination of New York by Robert Fitch. This was published in the 90s by Verso, a little leftist house in New York. This tells the story of how New York City came to be what it is today, which is basically a clutch of gigantic steel office towers and luxury residences with chain drugstores and nail salons and banks on every block. I'm talking about Manhattan and parts of Brooklyn now.
Don't forget coffee.
Coffee places, chains, McDonald's, 7-Eleven. This is a story of how the Rockefellers and the Morgans, the city's plutocracy, starting in the 20s, used urban planning, and there was no secret, to drive manufacturing out of New York City, to get rid of the port of New York with all those longshoremen, to get rid of the production side of the garment industry and the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, to move the blue-collar population out of the city, to make New York more and more a kind of white-collar preserve, which is what it's become now. This is not the doing of Robert Moses, you know, despite the brilliant biography by Robert Caro. It's not the doing of one man. This was the work of the plutocracy that ran and still runs New York City, where I happen to live and where I'm involved in constant activism to try to cut back this process of basically killing what's left of what was once an extremely vibrant and economically diverse city.
Well, and let's just point out that you have been risking biting the hand that feeds you as you take on your employers at New York University over their plans for massive expansion near Greenwich Village on the Lower East Side.
That's absolutely right. We are heavily involved in that struggle, which has been waged by the board of New York University, which is unusual not only for its size, it's a huge board, but for the fact that there is not a single educator on the board. It's all Wall Street honchos like John Paulson and Jamie Dimon. These are trustees of my university.
And you were kind enough not to correct me. My geography is off. It's the Lower West Side. Right?
Yeah, well, it actually is right in Greenwich Village where they want to build 2 million square feet of commercial real estate.
Yeah.
Nobody wants this, Peter. Nobody in the community, nobody on the faculty. The students don't want it. The only people who want it are these guys on the board, which also includes Larry Silverstein and other of the biggest real estate players in the city. This is the 1%. They are the trustees of NYU. And, you know, the fight we're waging here is a fight that's, you know, going on all over higher education, but nowhere is it as stark or as extreme as at NYU. So anyway,
I hope your tenure protects you.
Well, it does. We have a very powerful law firm representing us as we sue the city for approving the plan. And we have won a significant legal victory there. I'm actually confident we're going to win this fight. So this particular book is dear to me, not just because it's a great book and anyone in urban studies ought to read it, but also because it speaks directly to the dilemma that we're facing here in this neighborhood.
Yeah, great.
The fourth book also has assassination in the title. It's called Assassination on Embassy Row by Saul Landau and John Dinges, and it's about the murder of Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Moffitt on the streets of Washington, D.C. in 1976 by agents of Augusto Pinochet in Chile. This is a terrific book. It reads like a thriller. It tells the story of the crime and the solution to the crime, which, unusually enough, the FBI actually did a great job with. We have a new introduction by the Chilean poet and activist Ariel Dorfman, who knew Letelier. It's a beautiful piece, which I hope is published separately.
Well, I actually have read that book and interviewed Saul Landau, so I recall it, and I'm glad it's on your list.
Yeah, that's the fourth one. And then the fifth is The Polk Conspiracy by Cotty Martin. This is the story of the heroic American journalist George Polk, after whom the Polk Awards is named, who was murdered by Greek fascists in 1948 in Greece, agents of that government, which had been installed by the CIA. They found themselves a communist patsy to take the blame for his murder. And then William Donovan, formerly of the OSS, very close to the CIA, engineered a cover-up of the whole thing. Cotty's book actually got some good reviews when it came out, but it, you know, slipped right out of print. So we're bringing that back as well. And we have many others planned for the next few years. We're going to be dealing with some pretty honest books on Zionism, talk about hot potatoes, including I.F. Stone's Underground Palestine, which is, you know, a must-read today when, you know, we need to remember certain aspects of modern history and certain aspects of Zionism, which you know, had other faces than the kind of brutal warlike face that we've been seeing lately. A lot of books, some of them quite scary. And, you know, I have to say, Peter, I'm really grateful to you for having me on, because just as the corporate press didn't want to have anything to do with most of these books when they first came out, so do they not want to have anything to do with this attempt to bring them back, right?
Well, you know, why would you want to fix something that ain't broke?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the suppression worked before, so let's just keep ignoring these points of view and these historical accounts and soldier on with our own constructed and contrived reality, which is, you know, a lot of what they're trying to preserve.
Well, it is, and I have to say, you know, I mean, I hope that I become unable to say this in the coming weeks or months, but right now I can say that we have gotten just as little interest. We have managed to stoke as little interest in the left liberal media as we have in the corporate press. You know, Doug Valentine has a very useful phrase, and that is the compatible left the compatible left, which won't venture anywhere that the powers that be don't want them to venture, you know? And I have a feeling that that's probably operating in this case, that we're not going to get a hearing. I'm not going to name any names because these people may come through for us. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, we want their audiences to know what's up and to know that these books exist. But so far, it's authentically independent-minded journalists and personalities like you. I've been able to get on RT. I was on Tom Hartman's show, you know, and that's very helpful. But really, there is no excuse for continuing to turn a blind eye to such a broad range of issues of such importance, especially now, you know, when we're really on the brink. We're on the brink in terms of our civil liberties. We're on the brink economically. God knows we're on the brink ecologically. You know, it's now or never. You know, Ferguson is, I don't know if you've seen this great piece by you must have because you're on my list, that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar just wrote about Ferguson.
Yeah, yeah.
Saying that it's the coming race war, it's not about race, it's about class.
Mm-hmm.
That these robocops from coast to coast are out to kill the poor. And that's a population that includes an unprecedented number of us. You know, 77 million Americans are now facing debt collectors. Yeah, this is a reality we don't get from the media, you know? So it's time for Americans to kind of reacquaint themselves with the best aspects of their political traditions and wake up to the economic realities that have kind of come to a head. And the only way to do that is to become educated about our past. You know, we're trying to make that possible with this new series.
Well, Mark, I'm really glad we got to talk today, and I appreciate the work that you're doing here, and as I expressed earlier, all the things you do, including your listserv and the news from Underground, are really valuable. And let me just take a moment to say that you often cover the costs of that work out of your own pocket. Occasionally, you'll break down and ask people for donations. But I'd like to just speak up for you today and say that I know I have a couple of well-heeled listeners here, not everybody, but a few. And if you would put him on your list for donations to progressive causes and to free thinking, I would very much appreciate it. Professor Mark Crispin Miller, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Peter. I really appreciate it.
Well, friends, we've got some reading to do. Head on over to ForbiddenBookshelf.com and check out these titles. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.